George, and thanks for giving us that interview. You wrote an article called Extending the Classroom that we can find online, and you're saying that the course as a model for learning is being challenged by communities and networks. What do you mean by that?
Probably best to start by looking at what it is that courses are in the first place. You know, courses are, you know, basically a, you know, a fabricated structure. You know, it's a bounded structure of information within a particular field. And so what we do as educators is we take key ideas within a discipline and we package them into what we think are appropriate units for instructional purposes, which means that, you know, courses are intended to serve instruction, not necessarily intended to serve learning. And most of us, though, speaking at least for myself, you know, when I want to learn something, I don't typically take a very linear approach to it. I jump around, I read resources, I might listen to podcasts, watch a video, talk to colleagues, attend a conference. So the overall experience is much less linear than the way courses have been defined, and certainly the way we use courses in universities and colleges. So when we start looking at networks and communities, these are structures that are more in line with how it is that we actually enjoy learning. So as I mentioned, you know, a course is a fabricated, bounded structure of a particular of information within a particular domain. Networks and communities are much, they're not necessarily the structures of the information, but they are ways in which we can explore information in different ways. And they're based, you know, more aware, at least, or more flexible or more attendant to the needs that individual learners have.
We see more and more teachers who integrate online learning communities and social networking in the classroom model.
You can definitely start to incorporate community and network-based models in the delivery of traditional courses. But I will say that as you start to do more and more of that, you more and more begin to question the value of courses. At least that's been my experience as I've started to adopt different approaches for teaching and learning.
You're also saying that the manner in which we learn needs to reflect the seamless nature of our learning, informal, knowledge sharing. Can you explain?
The way in which we need to consider learning is a, you know, a seamless experience that isn't just classroom activity, and it's something that is more emergent and less clearly defined than we've perhaps come to know courses in their current shape, of course. What I mean with that is our conversations that we have with colleagues. It might be a conference that we attend. We might go and visit a trade show that's related to something within our field. We might read journal articles that are outside of our particular domain of expertise, but yet they strongly inform what it is that we do. We also often encounter, especially with certain skills and information, we encounter them at the point of need. We don't always have knowledge in advance of a particular situation. It's much like if you sit down and write an article for a journal. Part of the process of writing an article is to explain what you have done with research or what your awareness is of a field. But a secondary component is also, while you're writing that article, you're reviewing the literature and you're engaging in conversations with people who've published similar articles in the past, or at least related to that. So it's that experience of doing something just in time, where your information doesn't exist or you don't have access to it in advance necessarily. It's whether it's as simple as a Google search for certain types of information, whether it's the attendance of a conference or taking a course, it's all of these things together that comprise the overall learning experience. Formal education is one part of it, and I wouldn't even think it would be the largest part of our overall learning and competence.
You also use the concept of learning ecology. Tell me more about this.
Well, that's probably something that would vary depending on who you ask that question. The concept of an ecology and a learning ecology, I think, is one that John Seely Brown was one of the first people I know that have thrown out that particular notion. But really, a learning ecology is the space in which learning happens. So much like an ecology in a natural sense, the nature of the ecology will determine the kind of plant life and animal life that will exist in that environment. So if you go out to a desert, you're not going to be able to grow a whole lot of fruit trees. And if you're in a particular part of, a rainforest, there's certain animals that you won't find there that you'll find in other areas. So an ecology is really a space that fosters and encourages the development of certain types of learning. We would likely use a different learning ecology for different types of learning and even for different stages of learning. You know, if I started with a group of undergraduate students, I would create a different environment of learning than I would if I was dealing with a group of master's level students, or even if you're just dealing with a group of educators who are simply taking a course for professional development. Once again, my focus in those instances would be to properly address the needs of that particular group of learners. So an ecology needs to serve the intent, or needs to be reflective of the intent of the learning itself, which means a classroom where you want people to be innovative, you want them to be creative thinkers, you want them to explore new domains of knowledge, you want, such as you might with a master's class. That has a different feel. That ecology, that learning ecology in that environment is different. And it's physically different. It's conceptually different. It also has a different feel. Whereas if you're dealing with an undergraduate course where you maybe are working on creating a base level of information or knowledge for individual learners, it's not going to have that same creative, innovative feel to it, because you're still trying to form a base and introducing learners to a particular field.
You were the first to use the word connectivism back in 2004, and you say that connectivism represents the act of learning as a network formation process. What do you mean by that?
Sure. Well, probably worth very briefly looking at, learning theories as such. And I've made the statement in the past that connections are to learning as atoms are to physical matter. And with that, I'm basically advocating that educators need to recognize the primacy of a connection in the learning process. Now, when we say, well, what do you mean by network learning? It's worth explaining at least on three levels. First of all, in a very real sense, in a biological sense, when we learn, it's through neurons connecting and forming connections and patterns of connections. But we also, in a network sense, we learn conceptually, which means as we incorporate a new idea into our conceptual framework, our learning and our viewpoints and our perspectives are enhanced and extended. And so it's on the second level, it's conceptual. And then on the third level, it's the social and external dimension of learning, which technology has made this element much more prominent. But it's worth noting that, well before we ever had technology, we really were still primarily network learners, at least at a neural and a conceptual level. But with external social dimensions, through the rise of Facebook and the access to tools like Google and mobile phones, and we're much, it's like Karen Stevenson says, I collect my knowledge and my friends. And the assertion here is basically that people are more aware of how they're connected to other people. They're more aware of how their relationships or connections to others inform their own understanding. So on a given day, if I need to know something about a subject matter, I'll, through a series of searches in databases, reading articles, reading books, talking to colleagues, joining online communities, connecting to people on different social network sites. That's really the point with connectivism that I was seeking to make, is that learning itself and how educators view learning needs to be focused on understanding what a connection is, why connections form, how the addition of new conceptual or social external connections, how the addition of that influences our existing level of understanding. And so as we move forward with education into the next 50 years, that we're properly understanding the value of being connected and the value of having certain degrees of conceptual relatedness between different ideas, how that influences the quality of our understanding. And the goal of an educator becomes one of assisting learners in forming appropriate, first of all, social and external connections, because that's what will inform conceptual connections. And the depth of understanding that a person has, when someone understands a field well, like physics, typically what's happened is they have a nuanced level of connectedness between the main concepts within the field of physics, and they understand how alteration of one element will influence the entire network of understanding. So that's, I think, the primary point I'm trying to communicate with connectivism, again, is the primacy of the connection and the importance of educators better understanding what it means to be connected and what the impact is of being connected in a certain manner.
On your blog, you say that it's a rather delightful time to be in the knowledge, learning, education, technology field. I can only agree with you on this. And thanks a lot for the interview, George.
Thank you. My pleasure.